the more that these guys fall started, I actually got more relaxed, you know? So again, it's I think it's always really? Been my innate ability to focus, and my innate ability to be very disciplined, and also to not care about what's happening with the lane right over next to me. Canada was known as participants. I mean, we are nice people. We go in there and it's kumbaya and beautiful and all of those things. And I was the guy that, I was a fierce competitor. I was essentially the Michael Jordan. Track and field is like boxing. I mean, Lennox Lewis and a couple other really great boxing champions are very close friends of mine. And I always laugh with them because I'm like, hey man, the 100 meters is really boxing, but I'm not fighting one guy. I'm fighting like seven guys like every day. I'm going to give you guys a 10 to 15 meter lead. And if we don't win gold, I'm fighting you guys on the track. Straight up. And I was dead serious.
You weren't joking.
I was not joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely not.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a coach and speaker. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. Today, I have a very special interview. The fastest man in the world and the GOAT for many years, Donovan Bailey, also a world record holder in the 100 meter. Just a wealth of information, very endearing, off camera and on, very genuine, an amazing interviewee. He's different than pretty much all the others I've interviewed, who are all amazing in their own way. But for him, just you can feel the oozing, the great confidence that comes from deep inside of him, and super straightforward. He's unafraid to speak his mind, and listen to how he changed the mindset of the entire team, which is incredible and doesn't hold back, but also very caring. And this also has an effect on the track team and speaks to him as a leader and a teammate. And the effect on his teammates, his friends, is undeniable too. When we look back to the 96 Olympics, we often forget about the Atlanta bombing during those games. And I'd forgotten about that until I was doing the research in preparation. But listen to how he navigated that and his ability to relax and focus at the proper times, at the most important times. And it really is amazing that ability. We could all learn something from him in that regard. And just what led to his success also is just being coachable, and listen to how he wants to be surrounded by the very smartest people in the room, but he has his own take on it in a way that really is good and endearing in its own way. And so I hope you get a lot out of this interview as much as I enjoyed conducting it.
Hello, everyone. This is Darwin, and I have a very special guest today. My hope after listening to this podcast is that you will learn something about excellence, because my guest today is Donovan Bailey. He is one of the greatest of all time, certainly the GOAT for many years, two-time Olympic champion, three-time world champion, two-time world record holder, the fastest top speed ever recorded in history at 27.07 miles per hour, only surpassed by Usain Bolt, now giving back in cancer, Alzheimer's research, building schools, big brothers, big sisters. He's doing everything. The legendary Donovan Bailey. Mr. Bailey, how are you today, sir?
I like that. You're pretty excitable, man. This is great. You know, listen, it's awesome to be here today, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you, and I'm in good spirits today.
Awesome. Great to hear. Now, Donovan, to make a national team is one thing. To do it in the 100 meter is another. How many people run? It's hundreds of thousands. To be an Olympian is yet another thing. Olympic champion is a thing. But then you're a world record holder on top of that. And you did something that no human had ever done before. And this is a question that very few people on earth can answer. And you're one of them. What is it about you that allowed you to forge that path that no person, no human had ever gone before? What is it about the mindset that allowed you to do that?
Well, I can only contribute that to my parents and to my upbringing. My parents are Jamaican. I was born in Jamaica. And I think that, from a very young age, my mom and my dad always said I could do anything I wanted to do. And there was no limits to what it is I could achieve. So my ability to focus and also to work hard and to be very disciplined you know, is something that I learned very young. And so when I set out to compete and when I set out to start training and take track seriously, then, I knew I was blessed with, great, God-given gifts, but I also knew that, I had the work ethic. But after I got to the team, the coaches and all of that, training partners, I recognized that I had the innate ability to be focused and to be disciplined and put the work in. So at some point in my life that there should be an expectations that I was going to do some things that no one had done before. I mean, I didn't know what it was, but I mean, I knew that I was capable of doing that. And I certainly had the support from a very young age.
Wow, amazing. And at the 96 Olympics, you crowned the fastest man on earth and in history. And during that race, there's more kind of about your mindset that is revealed there. Linford Christie false starts, Atta Bolden false starts. Christie disqualified again for false starting, and there's a bit of an argument there. And you and the other competitors, come out of the blocks. But it seems to me, obviously that for a normal person, that would have thrown them off, I think. But for you, it didn't seem like it had that effect. And so there's something else, about focus or poise or maybe a self-belief. And I'm wondering if you can talk us through that.
My God, listen, that was, funny enough, the false start episode in Atlanta, it was the reason why our entire sport, so track and field worldwide, changed the rules. I knew that, I knew coming into the Olympic Games, I was a reigning world champion.
Yeah.
And I knew that Linford was going to try and get out. Otto is always a pretty good, consistent starter.
Yeah.
But I also knew that because I've been doing it all year, I'd have terrible starts, but I just relax, stay in my path and think about, the three transitions that I need to go through in my race.
Yeah.
So, I understood what I needed to do. It was, but certainly it was, I knew that Atlanta was for me to lose. And so if I stayed relaxed, I'd already done all the work. Remember, Darwin, that 12 hours before that, there was a bombing in Atlanta. And I think, funny enough, a lot of people forget about that. So 12 hours, I think it's 12 or so hours before the 100-meter finals, there was a bombing. We were on, first of all, we didn't know the damage. We didn't know if people were injured or died. There was called that the Olympics was going to be canceled. Yeah. So imagine that, I'm at the Olympic Games, I go through two rounds. I go through the heats, I go through the quarterfinals, I go home, eat, watch TV, get a massage, go to sleep, wake up in the morning, and there's a bombing. So that's how my day started. So, by the time, I was fully protected. I had six or so RCMP officers with me at all times. And, so by the time I got to the track for the quarterfinals and the finals, really, I was so focused. And ultimately, at the first false starts, I really just wanted to kind of get the race over with. And the more that these guys false started, I actually got more relaxed. So again, it's been my innate ability to focus, and my innate ability to be very disciplined, and also to not care about what's happening with the lane right over next to me. So it really didn't bother me what was going on with any one of my competitors. And frankly, I was as comfortable as sitting in my living room watching TV,
Really?
So the finals to me was, I'd have done all the work. And I was also dealing with an injury, which a lot of people didn't really, I think that Dan, we're talking more about it now or have spoken more about it. I tore my left adductor in France a few weeks before that. And Mark Lindsay and his magic hands had gotten me back to good enough to compete. My focus has always been, Dan always says I have probably the greatest ability to compartmentalize things of any athlete he's ever known. And he's certainly known some greats. And so sitting in the blocks, I mean, my responsibility was to, you know, kind of, you know, every time it's almost like there's a calm over me, and I was listening to Dan in my head, all the things that we had done before. So, you know, it was a time for me just to relax and get out of the blocks, not panic, because I could have done that and messed up real bad. But to get out of the blocks, not panic, run my race. If I ran my race the way I was supposed to, Dan thought I should have ran high 9.6, maybe 9.71. But you know, I did what I did, and I still broke the world record. So
you did.
No, so I'm happy about that.
And during the race, and I'll flash it up as we talk here, you also, you know, coming out of the blocks, you were a little bit behind, and it also speaks to probably your ability to focus. But here, you must know that you're slightly behind, or maybe you don't if you're not paying attention to the other lanes. But what goes through your mind to reset or to, you know, focus on your race plan or relax or whatever? Do you go through, if we can kind of find out the secret sauce here, what is it that you did or do that we might be able to learn something from?
Well, one, I mean, I think that the thing that I learned, one of the things that we do in practice is going through crazy monotonous training. It's boring. And I mean, Dan will tell you if you ever speak to him, or even Glenroy, well, actually any of the guys, I actually hate training because it's boring, it's monotonous, but it's those things that you think about in those situations. I mean, it's almost like listening, if you're a basketball fan, it's like listening to when people talk about Stephen Curry and he goes to practice and he's shooting 100 threes, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We go through the same thing in track and field. I mean, you know, a hundred times I'll run 30 meters, and it's 30 meters outside the blocks. I mean, out of the blocks, and understanding my drive phase, relaxing, not worrying about anyone around me. And I think that what you see there is that I was the sixth man out of the blocks, and my responsibility was not to panic. I mean, if you panic, it's over for you. In the 100 meters, you have one thousandth of 1 second to make a possible mistake, correct that possible mistake, and then go on. I mean, so you have nanoseconds. And so I got out of the blocks. I knew I had a terrible start.
Yeah.
But I also was confident in my top speed and that no other human being had ever achieved that. My responsibility then was to just get back, not panic, get back in my drive phase, and go through the motions, and through the cycles of the actual 100 meter race. So, I got out. It was a terrible start, but my job was then to relax. I took a deep breath in, and obviously, pumping my arms,
yeah.
Understanding where my shin angle was. As I'm driving to get the top speed, and you saw the rest.
So it sounds like you're really relying on your training and your process, and then that just kind of takes over, and that's what you're focused on.
Well, my ability has always been, and I always say this to people, I mean, there's not a lot of people that's coachable, and I am not a coach because I just don't have the patience to deal with someone who can't listen. And so Dan is always been an incredible provider of information as to exactly what you need to do in a 100 meters. He's one of the best, biomechanics guy in the history of the world. So, I listen to precisely every single thing that he does and every single thing that he says. So my ability to process, I didn't really need to take long. I mean, Dan and I always spoke about ensuring that I am prepared to learn. So if I'm at home and there's something else happening there, I didn't sleep well or had a nightmare or whatever, he's like, dude, don't show up here unless you're like a sponge. So I'm always someone who learns a lot and is constantly a student. So Dan knew that I'm not really going to make a lot of mistakes in a race. I mean, frankly, in probably all of the 100 meters I've ever ran in my life, I can think of only one that I made a horrible mistake. But I'm always someone who have been able to process information when it's given to me by my coach, and also understand that this is not a team sport. It's singular. Mm-hmm. So if I screw up, I'm the one that's going to be like really pissed off at myself. So the 100 meters, I mean, it was my first time at the Olympic Games, and I'm like, yeah, I'm number one in the world, and I'm going to make this thing count for me. So Dan has always been an incredible provider of information, and I've always been able to process it because I've always come to practice wanting to learn.
And obviously that's the individual 100 meter, but also you won a gold in the relay, and that's obviously a team dynamic there. And the relay team has, you know, maybe not the best, the heat's going through, and it turns out that Richard Carlton is not maybe perhaps running the best. But then someone named Robert Esme, who we've both spoken to as well, shows a certain hunger and an ability and steps in and fills that void very well. And I just wanted to play a clip of our talk and a clip and get your take, and also on Robert, because okay, I think it's interesting what you see, what the team sees from him. So here it is here.
Want them to go back to the area of fun. And that's part of the haircut. Because I know when they can see the haircut, I know they're going to laugh. I know Donovan's going to call me a clown and slap me as usual, right? But although he may do that, on my mind, it's where I wanted him. Because I saw the fun piece and the relaxed piece that I'm looking for. I saw the smile on Glenroy's face. Like, this guy is gone another level. I saw Bruni laughing. He's at another level. At that moment, that was the reaction I'm looking for. Because I wanted to feel like we're on the playground at school when we're playing tag.
And it's...
Right. He said I'd call him a clown and slap him on the back of his head, right?
Yeah. And he meant that in an endearing way.
But
there's something about Robert Esme that the team notices, showing a hunger or an ability, and he steps in and he does a really good job, and obviously the team wins gold. And what, when you look back and you see kind of what Robert did to in such an atmosphere when the team had not been running well, and then to do that in the whole dynamic of you know, everything that had happened as well. Glenroy had a personal disappointment in the 100 and nearly had left the Olympics. And Bruni had a disappointing Olympics, and he was down for a while. And then Robert Esme comes in for Carlton. Just what did the team atmosphere, that the teamwork look like headed into the final?
Let me clarify a few things. One, when I, as the captain of the team and the leader of the team, the very first thing I had to do, and this happened in 19, this happened 2 years before the Olympic Games, I had to change the mindset and the attitude of all of those guys. And frankly, the entire track team. Canada was known as participants. I mean, we are nice people. We go in there and it's kumbaya and beautiful and all of those things. And I was the guy that I was a fierce competitor. I was essentially the Michael Jordan. I mean, I was a guy that I was gonna come in and I was gonna lay it down in the 100 meters. I knew what my personal ability was, but I think that I've been very hard on those guys, very hard on those guys, because I had huge expectations. And I told those guys that if you're showing up and you're not prepared to run, then we'll find someone else. To replace you. That's just what it is. I mean, you know, so we had won Commonwealth Games. So we're the number one team in the world in 94, 95, we won the world championships. You know, coming into Atlanta, I mean, we weren't bad. We were actually running quite good as a team. you know, certainly Glenroy had, you know, definitely some off-track issues that he was dealing with. And my responsibility was to get him focused and get him ready and understand that this is the greatest time of his life and he needs to get that organized. Carlton had a long season at Clemson. So him getting a hamstring tear was probably not a surprise, you know, at the end of the day. It really wasn't, because he had a very long season coming from Clemson. Bruni probably had a mental block. Again, Bruni always sometimes lose focus under pressure. He tends to focus or veer off to other things. You know, so I knew what my job was at the Olympic Games individually. I knew that I was going to go out there and I was going to do what I was going to do.
Yeah.
But I also knew that, you know, in the first round, I mean, I remember having a conversation with Bruni and for me saying to him, we need to shorten. Well, Carlton ran well. Glenroy is always stellar on the backstretch. Glenroy, probably one of the best sprinters Canada ever had, that he never recorded a time that he's in there. I mean, Glenroy should have been a sub 10 guy every time he ran. But Glenroy is going to always run well on the backstretch. Bruni got the baton, maintained the lead in the heats. But I also had said to him, we had to shorten our receiving zone, because I just come off the 100 meters, and again, I'm on a different level. I'm on a different level. So, yeah, I mean, again, when I took off, I recognized that Bruni wasn't going to catch me. So I saw the receiving zone coming up and I just slowed down. I slowed down just enough to get the baton. I mean, I think a lot of people were panicking. I mean, yeah. I felt I was in full control of that, because if I'm the outgoing runner and Bruni's coming in, I can always slow down to receive the baton. And I have to be so aware of everything else that's going on. But I got the stick. We got through. Bruni knew now that he had to shorten it, because again, I just ran the fastest time in the history of the planet. So going into the finals and Robert was, you know, chopping at the bits to come out. I mean, realistically, all I wanted Robert to do was to come out and beat John Drummond, because if he beat John Drummond, then we're about to break the world record.
Right.
But I recognize it. If it's his motivation to save his head, I thought that was kind of silly. I was still very serious, because no matter what he says and or what he looked like, he had a leg to run. And there is the baton is the most fragile thing in the history, you know, of anything. If this is the thing that if you don't exchange it, there's no need to continue running. So I wanted him to have a good start, and I wanted him to beat John Drummond. Now, John Drummond put a big beating on him in the first leg. But again, Glenroy, you know, made it up on the backstretch. Bruni maintained it, and then I opened it up again. So there was, you know, I think the dynamics of our team, everyone can tell their own personal story, but I can tell you what the story is. And because I'm standing on the track on the fourth leg and I'm seeing every single thing that's happening, you know, so at the end of the day, completely elated, the five guys that were part of that squad, should be recognized as the greatest team in the history of Canada. We're the only team in across any sport that for 6 years in a row, we were the number one team on the planet. And again, I mean, whatever Robert did, I thought it was a little silly. I don't know if I laughed, but I thought it was a little silly. But I mean, again, his responsibility was I wanted him to go out and run 10-3 out of the blocks and give it to Glenroy, you know, where Glenroy could, we know that Glenroy is going to hold that thing like an egg. And he's going to hum down that backstretch and give it to Bruni. You know, so we did that. I mean, and you know, when I meet up with the guys or when we have a conversation, one of the incredible things that we have today is that we can sit and laugh and talk and think about the incredible memories, because we've done something and we've made something of ourselves that we can share with Canadians and the world of track and field, and the world of Olympic sports, for eternity. And so we can sit and laugh about anything right now, but you know, my my leadership ways and the fact that I had expectations of all these guys have allowed all of us now to celebrate you know, some incredible achievements.
And it's well known that, I mean, you're not afraid to challenge and to push and get in faces, whatever the phrase might be.
Right.
And as we know, it paid off. And I'm sure you've seen this, you know, umpteen times. But when you look at the race, the 4x100, what goes through your memory? What do you remember about that? So it's coming around and you're going to Glenroy. And what are you thinking at these moments?
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny. Every time I actually see the race, I always think, why couldn't Glenroy run 100 meters like that?
Oh. Like,
I realize you need to put a stick in his hand. No, but I'm telling you, I mean, that's okay. Again, it's a personal thing of what I've wanted for Glenroy because yeah. It's a brotherhood. And I am one of four boys, and I'm one of five boys in my family. So I've always been very hard on my brothers. I grew up that way. So I've always been hard with these guys. So yes, I mean, I see Glenroy and see how detailed he is and how precise he is and how fantastic his mechanics are. But when I remove myself from it and I can talk about it as a team, you know, I think about the fact that, I achieved something personally that I'm still compared with the fastest human beings that ever lived on this planet, and the fact that we're and a gold medalist. But when I look at the team, I'm like, it's the same thing, and it's always incredible when you win with a team. Sometimes when I look at basketball or baseball or football or hockey or whatever, you kind of see teammates, and it's amazing when you win by yourself.
Yeah.
But you're on a podium by yourself. Now, when you win as a team, it's so incredible because, again, you know, Bruni Surin would not be Bruni Surin if he didn't win a gold medal. Robert Esme, you would never speak to Robert if he wasn't a gold medalist and a champion. And Glenroy is the same, and Carlton is the same. And so when I look at the race, I'm like, yeah, we did that. We did that. And the only thing that we can do, one, is help mentor the young kids that are up right now and you know, the Canadian team right now with Aaron and Andre and, you know, Jerome and a few others, you know, these guys have the potential. They have the potential. And what we can do is you know, let them know that, listen, there's a seat at the table in the Hall of Fame, man, and you need to get out and do your thing. I mean, you know, individually, I'm saying the same thing to them. But as a team, it's so incredible. It's absolutely so incredible to look at and understand that you've celebrated victory at the highest level, and to be serenaded by your national anthem in front of the planet, where the entire planet is watching. I mean, it's one of the few sports in the world that the entire planet's watching.
Right.
And so when I look at it, you know, and I look at the team, I kind of go, yeah, it's so good. I mean, after that race was done, I actually went out and I made the big, like, NFL, at the time, the NFL or Major League Baseball, those big diamond rings.
I actually
bought the entire team that. I mean, as the captain, I went out with Justin Scanada and I bought them all. I bought, like, everyone on the team, including the staff, got a ring from me.
Amazing. Real teamwork. And there's something else that speaks to what you're talking about here, which is about teamwork, because on the track, you're fierce competitors and you're competing for spots on the team and then for medals. And yet you're also a very good teammate and a friend and supporter for Glenroy. And there's a clip when I spoke to him, and I wanted to get your take on this too. And just to hear what Glenroy had went through and kind of your impact on him at the time. So this is before.
Right. Really, really hard to get ready. I have won medals in the relay. I wanted to make the Olympic final in Atlanta. I didn't winning a medal. I knew that was going to be a long shot in 100 meters, but to make the final, I thought it was something I was capable of doing. I trained all year for it. Got to Atlanta. Things leading up to that, I was married. My marriage fell apart. I was went to the trials in Montreal. I was low. I was the lowest I'd ever been. I relied on my teammates, Donovan. Donovan was huge in this moment. He really helped keep me on track, pick me up during the trials. I was able to finish third in 100, make the 100-meter squad for the Olympics. When I got to the Olympic Games, again, the focus continued, and that was going to be to make it to the final. That was it. Went through the heats, that was okay. Went through the quarterfinal and finished, I want to say I was maybe fifth in the quarterfinal. I was in a race there with Otto Bolden and did not advance.
And he goes on to tell the story of kind of how the Olympics individually didn't go well for him and you know, went in his room and almost didn't come back out for the relay and almost left. But you'd helped him before that through a very difficult period. Although you're competitors, although you're competing in some ways for the same thing, and yet you were a very good teammate. And that's an interesting dynamic there because, as you say, you're the captain and you're the leader and the whole world knows you. And at the same time, you're a good teammate to someone who's competing against you in some way. And I wanted to ask you what that was like for you.
Wow. Well, you know what? Not often. I mean, sometimes you forget things. I mean, I think that things that are naturally me, I don't think about it as doing good things. I mean, we're in a place right now, Darwin, where a lot of people are talking about mental health.
Yeah.
And again, and it's great that we can have that discussion. Now, I understood one that personally, I was going to be ready for Atlanta. Glenroy is also my training partner. And I understood a lot of the other things that was going on. I mean, I hear the dynamic and I also see him. We train every single day. So I know when he's happy, you know, when someone is down, you know, so I knew going in, track and field is like boxing. I mean, Lennox Lewis and a couple other really great boxing champion are very close friends of mine. Mm-hmm. And I always laugh with them because I'm like, hey, man, you know, the 100 meters is really boxing, but I'm not fighting one guy. I'm fighting like seven guys like every day or weekend or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Glenroy, I mean, like you have to understand the dynamics of a brotherhood. With a relay team, I'm out there and all of those guys want to kill me, right? And then I have to beat them, and then I have to turn around and go hug them and bring them all together back in a camp where everybody is happy and everyone is satisfied with what it is that they're going to do. Now, I knew that Glenn was going through some stuff, but it was my job as a leader to go and sit down and hug him and go sit down and have a conversation with him and go tell him, you know, how much, you know, one, I love him or I respect him and we need him. And the fact is that there's an opportunity for a goal that he himself has been working his ass off for, you know, and I think that sometimes people don't think about those things. I mean, this is not the first time I've done it to teammates. I mean, it's not something that I write in my diary at the time or it's not. I mean, I will go out of my way to go and help teammates, whether or not I'm going to help them pay their rent or get them into a track meet or get them a better agent or get them a better deal, you know, a shoe deal. I mean, these are normal, natural things that I would do as a leader. But Glenroy and I have a great, you know, relationship. And yeah, at the time I knew he was going through some things. And so my responsibility really was to get in there and let him know that I'm his brother, that we had been working our asses off, and he should not squander that. So I'm very happy that one, Glenroy got through. We, you know, he probably wanted to make the finals in 100, but he didn't. I knew that he was going to, again, when you look at the relay, you can think about what Glenroy just said, right? Or what Glenroy had said to you in the past. I mean, Glenroy was so focused and had he ran that race, then Glenroy would have been in the finals. Frankly, Glenroy would have been way up in the finals with me. Glenroy might've been on the podium with me if he ran that race that he ran on that backstretch that day. But the G-man and I, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, I always tell him, I always look at him, I'm like, dude, one of the most talented guys I know, one of the smartest guys I know, one of the hardest working guys that I know. But yeah, I mean, I've always been there for those guys. I'm there for those guys today. I mean, I can pick up the phone and call Robert to just find out what he's doing. I talk to Carlton very often. I talk to Bruni often. I talk to Glenn Roy often. I just want to make sure that, you know, we're all in that same space where if you need help, whatever that help might be, mental, psychological, physical, like whatever it is, we're there. We're a team for life, and still is the guy that that is known more than all of them. You know, I'm certainly the guy who still want to captain that ship and make sure that we all get to a place where we're incredible, productive members of society and incredible mentors for these young cats trying to get on top of the podium and get to a place that we found very comfortable basking in every week or every year.
I can see it. You really care about these guys. And
absolutely.
You share a forever bond and forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. My mom had five boys, man. So I'm used to being around men and testosterone and all of that. I'm also used to being a leader amongst them, you know. The team was like child's play. It was normal. It was very normal for me, you know, to give them all a hard time. And let them know that there's incredible expectations. And if you're part of the team, we are not going to settle for anything less than gold. I think I told the team in 1994 in Victoria at the Commonwealth Games. I said, first of all, I should have been running the 100 meters where I would have won and broken the world record on Canadian soil. So when I did not get selected for the team because I was sick, I understood that. But when I came out for the start of the relay, I said to Glenn Roy, I'm like, dude, I'm going to give you guys a 10 to 15 meter lead. And if we don't win gold, I'm fighting you guys on the track. Straight up. And I was dead serious.
You weren't joking.
I was not joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely not.
When you look at your career and you serve as a mentor now to many people, and both on the track and off. And during your career, you were a mentor. And you were quoted in CanadianImmigrant.ca when asked about what it takes to be successful. Everybody needs a mentor.
Right.
So how do you view like a good sort of mentor-mentee relationship?
You know what? I always tell people that, in my appearances or corporate speeches, you know, or workshops, board meetings, I always tell people to seek out the smartest people in whatever industry you're trying to be successful in and just have a conversation. Sometimes shut the hell up, just actually listen and see how they do things. And I've always met and had fortune to either, you know, meet incredible people or seek them out and just want to have a conversation, being in the same room as them. I've always said that I want to be the dumb guy in the room. I want to be able to get in and absorb as much information as possible, you know? These are some of the mannerisms that I use to this day still. There are some incredible business people that I know, and I can pick up the phone, I can call them, and I can discuss anything. There's some economists that I know, I can call them, and I can talk about anything. Great media people that I know around the globe. Some of them, you know, like you've got some of the greatest people to ever do these things. I can pick up the phone and I can call them. You know, when I can pick up the phone and call the prime minister, you know, or I can call, you know, whomever. I can call any single person in any genre. Then that's how it is that I see myself. So I continue to help people by letting them know that if they want to learn something, one, be prepared to learn. Two, I mean, reach out. And there's not a dumb question when you reach out to someone, but don't get in their way. What you got to do is learn from them by understanding what they do, understanding the mannerisms and the mechanics that it takes for them to be incredible at what it is they do. I mean, I can pick up the phone and call someone, you know, is one of the best bankers in the entire country, and just find out from them how it is you know, what are your opinions on things, right? You know, so my responsibility on the platform that I have is just to let people know some of the simple skills that I've learned over the years, which is always reach out to the people that exactly, first of all, you got to be precise and disciplined. So reach out to the people that are exactly what you want to be or how you want to be, and listen carefully. If those people can spare 5 minutes of their time, make sure that 5 minutes count for a lifetime.
Amazing. And you had a legendary coach that you've mentioned also in Dan Pfaff. And what makes a good partnership or an ideal partnership between a coach and an athlete? You both excelled working together.
Right. Well, listen, Dan, I mean, obviously I'm going to say Dan is the greatest coach in the history of the world, because that's just obviously my own resume will say that. But I'll tell you, I don't know any one athlete, and I don't care what sport they're in, that's ever gone to Dan and never and not improve. Now, okay, that's the true sign of like a Hall of Fame, you know, greatest of all time coach, right? Every single person, whether or not that person was coming to do dry land, it's a dry land hockey guy, whether or not they're coming from the rugby premiership in Australia, whether they're coming in from soccer, whether there's tons of NFL guys, and baseball, football. I'm just saying to you that you just have guys who just want to come in shape. Guys are running 11 seconds and be like, can I break 11 seconds? So Dan is that coach that can customize his vision and customize a written workout to make anyone improve, right? Dan would take you and bring you out there and whatever, like he'd say to you, go and run your fastest time, then come with me. And then you'll learn some things in a very short period of time. And if you work and you do that, you're going to improve. So Dan is someone who probably is one of the smartest guys that I know. And also, he was also an incredible student. And he had, Dan is an incredible, I spoke to Dan a couple of days ago, it was his birthday. Dan is someone, like, I am someone, you know, I'm a student of the sport, so I always asked a lot of questions. One of the greatest things about Dan is that if he does not know the answer, he'll say, I don't know the answer. Let me think about that, and I'll get back to you. And believe me, after practice, he's either, remember, this is way before Google. So Dan is either getting this, an encyclopedia someplace, and his incredible network of coaches around the planet, he was going to call and he was going to go and get as much information as possible, so the next time I saw him, he would have an answer for my question. And so we were exchanging like intellectual academic details of what it was like to run. And I know people kind of go, yeah, you put one foot in front of the other. But there were some of the simplest basic things that you see in running, but you're thinking about it's probably the most complicated technical thing to do in the middle of everyone, because everybody can run. We all know that. But when you're the greatest runner and every human being on the planet can run, then it does take an incredible teacher and, you know, obviously an incredible talent. So Dan is one of those coaches for me that no matter where you put him, he's going to survive. And no matter what, he's going to offer you the greatest advice that he possibly can. And that advice, personally for me, obviously I'm very biased, that advice is the greatest advice you're going to get from anybody else in the world.
Wow. Incredible. And we talked to Bruni, and Bruni said very similar things about him. Just an amazing coach.
He better.
He did. Oh, he was very, very high on Dan Pfaff.
I invited Bruni to come train with us. Absolutely. I invited Bruni to come down and train with us, especially after I ruptured my Achilles. And Bruni learned so much. I mean, just one, you got to be around winners. You got to have a little bit of a chip. You can't, you know, you got to show up and you have to have that that mindset. And like I said, I changed the mindset of the entire team in 94 when I became the fastest on the team. And so going forward, having that and then having Dan as part of the team and, you know, having our physio and training facility, that's why we had such incredible results over those years.
Awesome. Looking back at your career, Donovan, even before your sprinting success, you were successful in a number of business ventures, which you know, marketing, properties, and apparel, and you're successful in many areas today. What are some of the common things that helped you in your athletic career that help you today with your business ventures and in your giving back in charitable, philanthropic sort of areas?
Well, you know what? I think that the characteristics to achieve success are all the same things.
Okay.
You know, one, you must learn about what it is that you're trying to do. Learn about your product, whether that product is that you're trying to be a stockbroker, you're trying to, you know, be the fastest man in the world. You know, I think that you need to attach yourself to the people that are already incredible at it and learn from them. So find yourself a good coach. The support system is still extremely incredible. You need to have, I mean, like Glenroy said, you need to have people that you can depend on, people that you can trust, and someone that can help you if you're having a bad day, and someone's going to help you along that way. You know, and probably more importantly, one, you make a commitment to yourself that you're going to learn, understand what discipline's all about. You know, also understand that your focus, and if you don't have passion for it, then you shouldn't be there. You know, my passion is winning. My passion is successful, or my passion is in being a success in whatever I'm doing. So you mixed all of those things together, and then you kind of understand what it is that's required for you to go there. You know, again, those are some of the simple characteristics. Certainly, there's a lot more. You know, training, whether you're on the track or in the boardroom, or whatever it is that you're doing, is very important.
Yeah.
But you have to be passionate about it. And also remember, especially in sport or in anything for that matter, it's a 24 hour a day choice that you've made. So you have to be passionate about something. It's a 24 hour a day commitment, you know, so you eat it, sleep it. I mean, you do everything for it, whatever that commitment is. And in order for you to understand how to be successful, you have to live and breathe it.
Donovan is just so rich here with your wisdom. And you know, you come from Jamaica, which is known for its amazing sprinting. And from your time in your athletic career and beyond, really seemed to help and help to usher in a new era of sprinting, where it became possible and it maybe even expected for others to do the same. So how do you view creating a culture really of excellence, with leaving that legacy, the idea of legacy? What does that mean to you, and how do you build that?
Well, you know what? I mean, I was blessed and humbled to be in a position to influence a lot of people. Yeah. And so my concern when I was competing and after was not necessarily just about track and field. I mean, you know, I've met journalists that are inspired by what it is that they saw me do and also hear me speak after. You know, I'm inspired by guys like Drake, who's from Canada, proud to be from Canada, but also is a global star. I mean, he's like, no, I'm not just here to be the best rapper in Toronto. I want to be the greatest artist and brand ambassador across the planet. So, I mean, you know, you see some of these hockey player guys, you see some of these kids now that are playing NCAA basketball that have gone on to play in the NBA, like, you know, Steve Nash is definitely one of those guys. You know, hockey is not across the planet. It's certainly popular in a few countries, but you see that, you know, guys are here that have the limitless thought in what their ability should be. You know, so I was in a space where I could influence everybody. It came from sport. It came from track and field. But it was, I mean, I knew that the world pauses to watch the 100 meters every 4 years. That will never end, you know. And we know that that's the leading news on every single media platform on the planet. You know, so I knew how big that was. So I recognized that I had to use that platform to make sure that anyone that was watching or listening, you know, understand that they had the ability to do whatever it is that they want to do. And it wasn't just about sports. So to influence a young crop of athletes or business people or musicians or whatever, you know, listen, I'm blessed that, you know, people have said that that they have attached me to this, but my attitude has always been the same. I'm always a glasses half full kind of guy. I'll always influence and motivate people to do better than themselves than what even what it is that they you know have put in front of themselves. I'm always pushing people to be better, and so yeah, for the platform, man, I just want to ensure that whomever was an earshot or visual shot. Throughout my career and after, they know that they have the ability to do whatever they need to do and be very confident and talk about it, talk about working hard, talk about being a winner. I mean, do that stuff. It doesn't, and it doesn't really matter for me. I mean, you know, regardless of some of the naysayers, some of the people that, you know, that might've said, I might've said some things that I shouldn't have said and all of those stuff. I mean, at the end of the day, it's 2021 right now. And I addressed racism, you know, in 1996. So, you know, a lot of people back then said there was no racism in Canada. And I'm like, you must be out of your mind, you fools. You know, I'm like, you don't get to talk about racism. You need to be listening to the people who are racialized. And this is, you know, 24 years ago. So again, you know, I had a platform and I want to make sure that I use that for good.
That's amazing. And my audience has been asking me to talk to you for a while now. It's obvious why. From lessons on greatness to mindset to team to coaching and to mentorship. And you've learned so much from mentors. And we've been able to be mentees to you and just so thankful and allowing us into your mind and your mindset and into your world just for a few minutes. And I learned so much and I know my audience will learn so much. And just sincerely, thank you so much, Donovan.
Well, listen. Thank you for having me, and I guess I'm the fourth of the, as it should be. I'm the anchor.
You're the anchor.
I'm very glad that you had an opportunity to talk to the fellas, and certainly, man. You know what? Shouts out to them and to your audience. Thank you for supporting me throughout my career, and thank you for continual support today. And let's hope that we can cheer on the young generation of leaders, whether on and off the track. We can cheer on this young generation of new leaders and future legends for them to get to a place where the world is an incredible equal place in the very near future.
What an amazing interview. I had so much fun talking to Donovan. And I appreciated so many things about him, how he challenged his teammates. Be ready or we'll find someone else. Just straightforward and be excellent at what you do. And then if you don't win the Olympic Games, I'm fighting you in the track. And I remember at the time, I laughed and I was unsure whether he was serious, but he was. And I could see that. And it was pretty amazing how he kind of fostered excellence and amongst his team, you know, called himself the Michael Jordan and just, I loved it. And, you know, my favorite moment was with the clip from Glenroy Gilbert in my interview with Glenroy. And we caught a glimpse there of the human inside of the competitor and how he really views his teammates as close teammates and friends. And it was very cool to see that. And then he talks about mentors, and that was refreshing to hear. It's easy to say that we should, you know, spend time with people and learn from people that are smarter than we are, but there's something else that I don't think honestly is emphasized probably enough. And
he says it so succinctly, shut up and listen. And it's so refreshing to hear that, because sometimes if we're honest with ourselves, I don't think always we really do want to learn from other people, and we're willing to just shut up and listen, as he says. And I really like that about him. He really truly cared about his teammates, and he used his fame as a platform. Speaking about racism, I respect that about him so much. And if you look on his social media, he uses fame to speak out and to help others. And he broke so many barriers in so many ways. So I've interviewed all four now of the 1996 4x100 meter relay team. So that's Glenroy Gilbert, Donovan Bailey, Bruni Sir, and Robert Esme. And as I look back, all four men broke through their own barriers, and I'm grateful to all of them for their insights and their stories and their amazing stories of camaraderie and how they broke through those barriers to reach, you know, further limits, and just amazing. And I'm Darwin with the Evolution of Leaders, and I help future awesome leaders break through barriers to fulfill their purpose. And I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did to speak to Donovan. I speak and coach, and I would love to hear from you. I'm at evolutionofleaders.com. Please like, subscribe, and share. Make sure you get 1% better today. Take care.